Is everybody here? Nobody sitting over in room 206 wondering why it's empty? Hoping they didn't miss the rapture or something? Yes. Yeah, where is she? Did anybody happen to go over there? And if so, did you notice if there's a sign on the door? All right, so worst case scenario, they'd see the sign and slip into class. All right. Man, I haven't been in this room in over a decade teaching. Oh, yeah. The whole 600 wing used to be classes, 601, 602, 603. Yeah, they were Bible college classes years ago. And brings back fond memories of Survey of Old Testament books and Survey of Old Testament history and some of those other classes I used to teach in these rooms. Huh? Yeah, and I think we had effective speaking in here too. Yeah. It's chilly in here, isn't it?
Yes.
I think this whole 600 wing is tends to be cold because I've got classes over in 604 next door. And that's a breezy room too, right? Know what it's like over in... What's that? Yeah, it's feast or famine, seems like. I don't know why. Really?
It was cold yesterday morning.
Somebody go to service ministries or something and...
Huh.
That's a cold air return there, I think. Yeah, there's people on this one. So it's coming in. It'll probably warm up even more than it is now because that's pretty warm air there. Okay. Where are we here, sports fans? Micah 5:2?
Yes.
Okay. Bethlehem Ephrata. The irony of the Son of God being born in an obscure hamlet in Judah, but symbolizing the truth of the paradox of the gospel, the willingness to humble oneself before God and then God's willingness to exalt one before Him. I gave you Matthew 2, John 7 last week. Yeah. The promise that a Redeemer would come is progressively clearer as history went on, from the vaguely general idea of the seed of the woman in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15. All that meant was that somebody was going to be born from Eve. He didn't say how far down the line. And undoubtedly, Adam and Eve had no idea it would be as many generations hence as it was. In fact, that's why they named Cain, gotten or acquired from the Lord. I've gotten a man, right? I've gotten a man from the Lord, but it could be rendered, I've gotten a man, comma, even the Lord. Indicating the possibility that they felt that this might be the one right there. See, the woman, here you are. Margie made it from 206 back into 603. All right. But it's a very vague promise there. But it's a hope that was set forth. Then he lets it be known that it will be from the seed of Shem through Noah, from Noah, not from Ham and not from Japheth. in Genesis 9, verses 26 and 27. So you know he is going to be a Semite, but that's still a broad spectrum, all of the descendants, the sons and the descendants of Shem. But then he makes this wonderful promise to the Semite Abraham in Genesis 12:3, and he said that in your seed shall all of the nations of the earth be blessed. So now it's down to this family. And then, of course, Abraham had Isaac, and Isaac had Jacob, and Jacob had 12 sons. And God says it will be from the tribe of Judah that the ruler shall come, Genesis 49:10. So you know that he will be a Semite who's from Abraham and through the tribe of Judah. Then in Psalms 89, verses 19 and 20, he lets it be known that the scarlet thread is to be traced through the family of David, that it'll be from the loins of David that the Redeemer will come. Here, of course, we have the very birthplace of the Messiah, that it will be of Bethlehem Ephratah in Judah. If I understand it right, Ephratah is either an older term for Bethlehem, or it's the surrounding area, and Bethlehem is a part of that. One or the other, but there's a relationship there. They're pretty much synonymous. Yeah, that's what I thought. And, of course, the angels made known right prior to that time who the very parents would be of that seed, that it would be Joseph as the stepfather and Mary as the mother in Matthew chapter 1 and Luke chapters 1 and 2. So it's progressive revelation here. All right, he says then, "But thou, Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall he come forth unto me." Notice, come forth, showing that there's a time when he came forth, the humanity of Christ. "Come forth unto me, that is to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting." Now that sounds like a contradiction on the surface, because if he's coming forth, if he's being born at a certain time in Bethlehem, how can his goings forth have been from eternity? Well, there's the deity of Christ represented, that it was God. And this goings forth is kind of a military term. Armies and kings with their armies were said to go forth in battle. And so it's a military concept of God and his many goings forth for his people, fighting for them, delivering them, healing them, saving them. And so he's trying to tell them here that this one is going to be God at the same time that he's going to be man. They weren't able to pick up on these, though, were they? Because they did not have, having eyes, they saw not, and having ears, they heard not. So this was lost on them, but it didn't have to be.
Great.
Yes?
I'm on a reference for that's Genesis 35, verse 19.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Genesis 35, 19. Thanks. Verse 3, "Therefore will he give them up until the time that she which travails has brought forth. Then the remnant of his brethren shall return unto the children of Israel." Now he's showing us the result of the ministry of this one who is born in Bethlehem, that they will reject him. And as a result, he will give them up. He, God, will give Judah up until the time which travails has brought forth. In other words, until that time of Armageddon, that pain, that pressure, that tribulation, he's given them up. But at that time, they shall mourn, they shall look upon him, they shall repent, and then he will be their God and they will be his people from that time and forward. He, God, not just God, but God in Jesus. "The nation is taken from you, kingdom is taken from you and given to a nation bringing forth the fruit thereof," he said. With this, Matthew 21:43, John 1:11, "came into his own received him not." So then there will be a remnant that will return. The ones that come through the fires of Armageddon will return unto the children of Israel. What that means is he's using Israel now in the spiritual sense, the true Israel of God. And, you know, versus Jacob. So when the Jews repent and put their faith and trust in God, then they are, as it were, returning to the children of Israel. Now they're the true sons of Israel. Now they're the true sons of God. True princes with God and prevailers with God, as we saw back in Hosea 12 analogy. Verse 4, "And he shall stand and feed in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they shall abide. For now shall he be great unto the ends of the earth." He, Messiah, verses 2 and 3, will stand and feed, or you could render that rule. Feed or rule. It's probably the idea of a shepherd in a pasture. And he's standing and he's causing the flock to feed. He is leading them. NAS renders that he will arise and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord. So God gives him the strength to be the good shepherd. So here we see Christ's victory over the world. Even as we are exhorted to, having done all, stand. He's going to stand. See, it shows victorious position. Ephesians 6:13. "And they will remain, and now he will be great unto the ends of the earth." So we see his humble origin, verse 2, his rejection, verse 3, but then his acceptance, verse 4, and when Israel accepts him, then he becomes great to the ends of the earth. In the millennium, Zechariah 9:10. And in the spiritual gospel age, now, he said this witness would be a worldwide, nationwide witness, so the world has the opportunity to realize his greatness, and to an extent they will. Verse 5, "And this man shall be the peace when the Assyrian shall come into our land, and when he shall tread in our palaces. Then shall we raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 principal men." Verse 5 is linked with verse 4. In the Hebrew versions, that they constitute one verse only. "But God himself shall be their peace." And God in Christ, even as Paul says in Ephesians 2:14, "For he is our peace, who has made both one and has broken down the middle wall of partition between us." Now, the Assyrians coming into their land, this is prophetic, and it's not so much prophetic of any dealings between Assyria and Judah after Micah's day. I suppose you could say it did have a fulfillment. It was Sennacherib. But really, when you look at the context of it, it's more millennial. And so the Assyrians, the cruel military war machine that they were, stand as a type of the Antichrist. So when the Antichrist shall come into their land, this man shall be their peace. And of course he is. He stops the Battle of Armageddon. And another reason you know it's millennial is he says, "Then," time key, "shall we raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 principal men." There's no historical fulfillment of that when Sennacherib and the Assyrians invaded Judah in 701. They didn't raise up 15 leaders against them. At least there's no record of that. And so it must be future. In the millennium, there are going to be those princes that rule with Messiah, king, according to Isaiah 32:1. And remember, we read in Obadiah 21, God would raise up saviors on Mount Zion that would judge the Mount of Esau. So God is going to have a duly constituted government and leadership at that time. Some feel it should be taken as a figure of speech, that there's not necessarily seven and then eight, but it's an idiom for a full and sufficient number. Seven, completeness, eight, a new beginning. I tend to take it a little more, I think it could be taken literally, but the other is a possibility. This is another one where some of the commentators, if I remember right, they kind of wring their hands in despair at not being able to find a real obvious historical fulfillment, and so they kind of shoehorn with the facts of history to try to find a fulfillment. And this puts people who take the preterist or historical view of prophecy, like Adam Clark does, that basically all prophecy has been fulfilled, this puts them in a real bind, because if there's no fulfillment, how are you going to find a fulfillment back there in history? Verse 6, "And they shall waste the land of Assyria with the sword, and the land of Nimrod." See, this didn't happen after Sennacherib's invasion either. The Jews didn't go up and waste Assyria. "And the land of Nimrod and the entrances thereof. Thus shall he deliver us from the Assyrian when he comes into our land and when he treads within our borders." To waste literally means to feed upon or to consume. NAS renders again, "They will shepherd the land of Assyria with the sword." But again, the idea is of rule there and control. Here, Assyria is called the land of Nimrod, or he's saying Assyria and Babylonia are both going to be conquered, because we know that Nimrod did found Babel, which became Babylonia. But it's my opinion that he also founded Assyria. Now, that's based upon a grammatical interpretation of Genesis 10:10, when it talks about him founding Babel, and then it says, "From him came forth Asher." And there's a way of looking at that and rendering it as he Nimrod went to Asher, and Asher is the Hebrew for Assyria, and that he founded Assyria as well. So he either founded Babylonia or Babylonia and Assyria, and so this is either talking about Assyria or Assyria and Babylonia with this chapter 4 verse 10, where he says, "Dwell in the city, and you shall go even to Babylon, and there you'll be delivered." All right, verse 7. Now, again, verse 6, messianic then. "He will deliver us from the Assyrian," that is the Antichrist, who is the antitype of the cruel Assyrian kings. "He'll deliver us from him when he comes into our land and treads within our borders." And we saw that in Joel, didn't we? The land was as the Garden of Eden before them and as a desolate wilderness after them. 7, "And the remnant of Jacob shall be," and the spiritual applications right across the board to the church, deliverance from demons through the lordship of Jesus Christ, the authority and the power that he's given us. "And the remnant of Jacob shall be in the midst of many people as a dew from the Lord, and as the showers upon the grass that tarrieth not for man, nor waiteth for the sons of men." So just like the dew refreshes the grass, revives it, so shall Israel be a refreshing spiritually to the Gentiles. For the most part, the Jews have been a curse historically, because they've been cursed. And that's why they've been so often the object of calumny and enmity, because they've been a greedy, crass, brash, abrasive type of people under the curse of God and without the peace of God upon them. But now they're going to be like the dew coming. Zechariah 8:23 here. And of course, God wants us to be the fulfillment of that as well. "Out of your belly shall flow rivers of living water." So again, the idea of moisture bringing life. "As a dew from the Lord." See, it's really God doing it, but through men. Here Psalm 72:6 says that He, referring to God, shall come down as the rain. Verse 8, "And the remnant of Jacob shall be among the Gentiles in the midst of many people, as a lion among the beasts of the forest, as a young lion among the flocks of sheep, who, if he go through, both treadeth down and teareth in pieces, and none can deliver." Point here is that Israel has been in subjection to many nations historically, but now they enjoy an exalted position, a position of authority and a position of power. Verse 9, "Thine hand shall be lifted up upon thine adversaries, and all thine enemies shall be cut off." So God's hand lifted up in judgment. Verse 10 through 15, it's double prophecy, Babylon and Armageddon. "And it shall come to pass in that day, saith the Lord, that I will cut off thy horses out of the midst of thee, and I will destroy thy chariots." Now the "thee" and "thy" here, God is addressing is Judah. Because again, he is going to have to remove their natural defenses and objects of confidence before they will turn to God in hope and confidence. That's what he's having to do to us. I was talking to somebody who said that the Lord had revealed to them that much of the credit for the uprightness and integrity and carefulness of their walk throughout their Christianity has been due to spirits of self-protection, and that the Lord had showed them that because of that they've lost a lot of the rewards that they would have otherwise had. And as they said, it was a very discouraging thing initially, but then God gave them a hope and let them know that he would come to them more and more in their life, they'd be able to release that spirit of protection, get rid of it, and then be able to minister or to live as a Christian in his strength. But see, that has to be shown first. Those defenses have to be exposed and removed before we will call upon God. If we don't feel a need for God, we won't call upon God. If we don't hunger and thirst after righteousness, we won't desire it. See, God has to allow these things to happen. So, "I will cut off your horses." God's doing it, but we know that he used Assyria, and he used later on Babylonia. But he's got to rid them of their natural defenses before they call on him. As long as our demons work for us, you know, quote unquote, then what need do we have of God? See. Notice horses, symbol of military might and of the power of man in Scripture. So we see here the destruction of Judah's defenses by Babylon, so that they would cry out to him in the captivity, so that he could cause them to return and to be restored. And the destruction of Judah's defenses by the Antichrist army, so that they will cry out upon him and accept Jesus as their Messiah. And, like I've already said, God purging the church prior to the rapture. Verse 11, "And I will cut off the cities of your land and throw down all your strongholds." We've got to come out of these strongholds, these demonic bastions that we have become ensconced in so firmly that we're firmly entrenched, and God can't get us out of them. Remember, we saw chapter 4, verse 3, "They shall not learn war anymore." God's going to cut off all of the carnal weapons, because the weapons of our warfare are not carnal but spiritual. They're mighty through God. Verse 12, "And I will cut off witchcrafts out of your hand, and you shall have no more soothsayers." So here again, showing the occult, the demonic involvement in the defenses that people have put within themselves. Witchcrafts can be rendered possibly sorceries or even incantations. Soothsayers can refer to users of hidden arts, or observers of clouds, or fortune tellers. But the point is, they are trying to divine the future by certain signs or other phenomena, and that's going to be cut off. Verse 13. "Thy graven images also will I cut off, and thy standing images out of the midst of thee, and thou shalt no more worship the work of thine hands." Well, that represents legalism, doesn't it? The Jews being ignorant of God's righteousness and setting about to establish their own righteousness are ignorant of God's righteousness, having a zeal but not according to knowledge. And so God is going to rid us of legalism, of demons, of natural strengths and defenses, so that we can finally stand with Paul and say, well, I'll glory in my weaknesses then, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. We don't glory in our weaknesses now. We're ashamed of them. We glory in our strengths, and we hide our weaknesses. Verse 13, graven images refers to idols then, made of carved wood or metal. And then the standing images refers to stone images, or some feel stones dedicated to idols. Rotherham has rendered standing images as pillars, Young as standing pillars. Just another form of idolatry. 14, and I will pluck up thy groves out of the midst of thee, so will I destroy thy cities. The groves refers to the stems of trees or of posts standing upright or set up as idols. Rotherham renders these sacred stems, young as shrines. And if I remember right, one of these represents the female aspect, and the other represents the male. And if I remember right, it's the standing images or stone images are the male representation, and the groves or the Asherah are the female, if I remember right in the Hebrew. So this literally happened at the Babylonian captivity, when all of this was destroyed by the enemy. And even before that, God raised up Josiah to burn Manasseh's idols and to make sweeping reformations throughout the land. 2 Kings 23:6. And then spiritually, at Armageddon, whatever their spiritual idols are, they will be purged of those. 15, and I will execute vengeance and anger and fury upon the heathen, such as they have not heard. So now he turns, says, and so notice the order. Judgment begins at the house of God. Then he turns and says, I'll execute vengeance in anger and fury. He didn't say he was using anger and fury upon his people, you notice. He just said he was going to chasten them, he's going to purge them, he's going to remove their defenses so they'll call out on him. But the heathen, those that have not obeyed the gospel, he will execute his judgment upon those that are ungodly. Such as they have not heard could be alternately rendered, which have not obeyed. So it's either saying what the King James is intimating, that is, it's an unparalleled destruction, something people haven't even heard of. Or it's saying, number two, these are judgment upon people which have not obeyed. All right, chapter 6. Hear ye now what the Lord saith. Arise, contend thou before the mountains, and let the hills hear thy voice. I apologize for being with a certain lack of unction today, but I'm absolutely drained and absolutely tired, and I'm doing the best I can, and I'm trusting the Lord to give something positive out of this, but I want to apologize for that, because I know I'm not quite with the program today. Contend is that legal lawsuit analogy here, contending before the mountains. RSV renders it, plead your case. Rotherham, maintain your controversy. So, under this lawsuit analogy of God bringing his case against Israel, he is about to set forth the proofs of his faithfulness to them and of his goodness to his people. And so, the mountains and hills are personified as though they were witnesses of the goodness that God has bestowed upon them through the centuries, and the subsequent rebellion and unfaithfulness of Israel to God through the years. 2, hear ye, O mountains, and of course these can represent nations and kingdoms spiritually as well. The Lord, hear the Lord's controversy, and ye strong foundations of the earth, for the Lord has a controversy with his people, and he will plead with Israel. Controversy, again, is continuing this idea. It's of a legal case. It can be rendered strife, or even an indictment. An indictment. NAS renders, because the Lord has a case against his people. And then he says, he will plead with Israel. And this is that same idea. He's going to contend or to dispute, or he will argue, or he will reason with them. Verse 3, O my people, what have I done unto thee, and wherein have I wearied thee? Testify against me. Notice he's still calling them his people. Though they have violated his covenant, he has not cast them off. And he is continuing to appeal to their sensibilities because he loves them and he wants to save them if at all possible. So he's saying, what wrong have I committed? And obviously this is said in irony. God is more than righteous. But he's trying to cause them to think about it and to think about it honestly and to be able to answer the question themselves. Well, God hasn't really done anything wrong. We have, but he hasn't. Wherein have I wearied thee? This means to weary the patience of someone by laying severe demands upon them or by breaking promises to them. So God is saying, I have not laid upon you more than you're able to bear. I've made a way of escape. I've given you the sacrifice and offering. I've given you covenant promises of mercy. And I have never broken my promises to you, never violated them. John says, this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous. And the Greek is, they're not burdensome. 1 John 5:3. We read in 1 Kings 8:56, there has not failed one word of all his good promise. So God has not broken his promises to us. And then he says, testify against me. In other words, answer me. What is your answer? Now he sets forth his case. For I brought thee up out of the land of Egypt, and redeemed thee out of the house of servants. And I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, consulted, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him from Shittim unto Gilgal, that you may know the righteousness of the Lord. So now he skips from the Exodus up to that time near the end of the wanderings period, when the Moabite monarch Balak plotted to destroy Israel by getting the prophet Balaam to curse them, but that by God's influence, every time he opened his mouth, he pronounced a prophetic blessing upon them four times instead of cursing them. And Shittim to Gilgal, this, the period that he is alluding to, includes not only the story here of Balaam the prophet, but the subsequent defeat of the Midianites by Israel. Israel crossing over Jordan under Joshua, entering the promised land, entering into circumcision again at Gilgal, and he's setting forth all of these as proofs of his grace and of his goodness and of his faithfulness, because he had promised that he'd give that land to Abraham and to his seed for an inheritance forever. And he's saying, I did it. Just like he could say to us, you know, what's your problem? I've saved you. I brought you out of Egypt. I led you. I've defeated the enemy before you. Legally, all things are yours. I've brought you into the promises of God. I've filled you with the Spirit. Pretty hard to argue against that. Verse 6, wherewith, notice the paragraph mark, new topic, Israel speaking, wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? Israel is, it's like they're feeling convicted after God has brought his case. And so it's like they're asking the prophet, as God's representative, what they need to do now. What would they need to do in order to appease God? And I think it's indicative of their spiritual state, that they're asking the question and how they get, what they're going to go on to say here, and even how they refer to God as the high God. Now, there's nothing wrong with using that title for God. He is, you know, El Elyon. I don't know if that's the Hebrew there, but I think it is the Most High God. But still, it's indicative of a relationship, and it indicates that sin has taken away their close covenant relationship. You know, instead of God or Yahweh, his name, now he's that far off God, way up on high. And how do they ever get back? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? Notice closely that the first thought in their mind is works. All right, what do I have to do now? 50 Hail Marys and 100 Our Fathers, light some candles, genuflex, come to confession, don't miss Mass, and everything will be just fine. This is the first thought when the heart is not right before God. Because when the heart is not right before God, the spiritual matters are lost. And so man tries to appease God with outward things. You know, Cain coming before the Lord with the works of his hands and so forth. Trying to atone for their own sins by following the outward written letter. But the Bible says the letter kills, but the Spirit gives life. So works righteousness will not avail anything before God. And he's going to answer to that end in two verses. Verse 7, they continue though, will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams or with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Now, oil formed a part of almost all of the Levitical offerings. And oil was expensive. And of course, rams, that was a fairly expensive sacrificial animal. So should we offer thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? Of course, this is a hyperbole. But it's showing where they're at. They're willing to pay almost any price. They're willing to really sacrifice. Jesus to Ephesus, I know thy works, and that thou hast labored for me, and has not fainted, and has tried them which said that they are apostles and are not, and has so on and so forth. But then he said, I have something against you. You've left your first love. And this is what we have here. Love of God means more to God than outward sacrifice without a heart of love, outward service. Mary and Martha illustrate that point in that story with Jesus. Now when they say, shall I give my firstborn, they may be referring back to the old practice of consecrating the firstborn son in the family to God, as in Exodus 13, verses 12 and 13. Or maybe they're still in such heathenism that they're saying, well, maybe sacrifice. You know, there were times under Baal worship and so forth that people actually did sacrifice their firstborn. Here, Jeremiah 19:5. And 2 Kings 16:3, we see that human sacrifice of this nature is practiced during the reign of King Ahaz, who is a contemporary to Micah here. So that was going on. In any case, this is what they're trying to do, is appease God with works. And then the prophet gives them the answer, verse 8. He has showed thee, O man, what is good. Notice, you already know what to do. No, there's no new revelation here. Remember, Paul says in Romans chapter 1, God has showed them. You know, they are, and even through the creation, God's eternal power and divinity is made known. But they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. And so God gave them over to a rejected mind to do those things which are improper. So they knew, all the way back to the time of Abraham, all the way back to the time of Adam, if you will, time of Moses in the law, Deuteronomy, for example, chapter 10 and verse 12. And now, Israel, what does the Lord thy God require of thee but to fear the Lord thy God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul? Also, you can put Deuteronomy 30, verses 11 to 14. He has showed thee, O man. This, again, is language that is reminiscent of Paul's universalisms in Romans, the first chapter, about man and mankind and where they stood before God and how they rejected God. He has showed the O man, here it's the Adam or Adam in the original, which sometimes refers, is used generically for mankind, the universal race of mankind. Jew and Gentile alike have all had a witness. Paul says in preaching that God, to the Greeks, God did not leave himself without a witness. He gave the rain, he gave the seasons, he gave the goodness and blessings. He let man know that there was a God. And he showed them in their own conscience, bearing witness with them. But they had rejected that witness, and they were not walking according to God's will and revelation anymore, so they were ignorant of it, so they had to be reminded. And what does the Lord require of thee but to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God? Now this is stated in such a way as to indicate that this would be something that anybody could do. What does he require of you but or except to do these three things? So the point here is that even in the old dispensation, God did never make it his plan constructed in such a way that it would be impossible to ever please God, impossible to ever be saved. Remember, Hebrews chapter 11, without faith it is impossible to please him. Then he goes and illustrates the point by showing us all of these Old Testament characters and how they were all justified by faith, not by the works of the law. By faith, Abel offered the better sacrifice. By faith, Enoch walked with God and was not. By faith, Abraham went out to the country that God showed him. See, by faith, Moses suffered with the people of God instead of the pleasures of sin in Egypt and so forth. All by faith. Now, to do justly and to love mercy, those are what I would call the horizontal aspect of man's relationship. And they would fulfill the second commandment of Jesus, love your neighbor as yourself. And if you love him like you love yourself, then you will do what is just in your relationship between him and you, and you will love mercy. In other words, that will be your keynote in relating to man, not loving judgment, but loving mercy, because you'll have the heart of God. You'll want to forgive others so that God can forgive you, and you will love them as you love yourself. Matthew 22:40, Matthew 5:23 and 24. But see, they didn't want to hear this kind of an answer, did they? Because if they just brought the required Levitical sacrifices, then they wouldn't have to deal with their own heart in relationship to one another and relationship to God. But God didn't even say anything about sacrifices and offerings, even though they were still required, of course, during that time, that covenant. Yet he goes right to the heart of the matter, just as Jesus always did in the Gospels. But man wants to part with anything but the idol of himself, self-God, anything but his sin. But God wants not our works per se, but our very being, our very heart. Love God with all your heart. And then once you're doing that, certainly he's going to have the works. The faith will produce the obedience. Faith which worketh by love. So he mentions the horizontal first. Then, number three is the vertical relationship. Walk humbly with God. So there's the first and great commandment. Love God with all of your heart, soul, and mind. Matthew 22:40. Jesus said all the law and the prophets hang on those two commandments. Of course, not even fulfilling these three requirements is the grounds of salvation. That's only our reasonable service, according to Romans 12:2. The grounds of our salvation is the grace of God. God so loved the world he gave. And faith is only the means of receiving that gift, receiving that grace, and walking before God. With this, Galatians 2:16. So they were trying to make it seem like, well, how could we ever please God? Verse 7, thousands of rams, 10,000 of rivers of oil. The devil comes in and tries to make it seem like, oh, this is ridiculous. It's too hard. I can't make it. I can't go on. You know, God is so severe and demanding. And then God comes with a still small voice and says, no. Jesus said, take my yoke upon you. My yoke is easy. My burden is light. Verse 9. The Lord's voice cries into the city,
and the man of wisdom shall see thy name. Hear ye the rod, and who has appointed it? So now he comes back to the situation that prevailed in Judah, and God's voice through Micah and other prophets was crying out to Jerusalem as representing Judah. And the man of wisdom, this is thrown in parenthetically, kind of like Jesus saying, whoso readeth, let him understand, concerning end time prophecy in Matthew 24:15. This man of wisdom will see God's name. Kind of an unusual way to put it, but I think what he's saying is, this man of wisdom will see God's hand in what's going on and in the judgment. And that God's trying to save them. He's doing it because he loves them. And therefore, they will fear his name. There is an alternate rendering from the Hebrew. It is wisdom to fear thy name. And he says, hear the rod, and who has appointed it? You know, just like listening to someone being beaten with stripes. And what he's saying is, don't just hear the sound of that chastisement, but hear the voice of God in it. What God is trying to show you, what God is trying to teach you, that it was unnecessary, it didn't have to be, there was another way, there was a higher way if you only would have taken it. Remember how we saw in Amos, God gave them famine, yet for all that they did not return to him. He withheld the rain from their cities, yet for all that they did not return to him. He did this and he did that, pestilence, disease, and so forth. And then he said in verse, this is 4:12, therefore, because of this, I will do this unto thee, prepare to meet thy God. In other words, the Assyrian captivity, you know, the last chastisement, the last judgment. So the man of wisdom will hear those stripes, and he will realize what the lesson that is to be learned, and who has appointed it. In other words, instead of saying, well, Assyria or Babylonia just kind of came in and took over, they'll realize who appointed that judgment, that it was a God-ordained chastisement and not mere coincidence in the course of history. But it takes wisdom in order to make that discernment. And that's why James promised, if any man lack wisdom, let him ask of the Lord. See, then we know what's happening and why. Verse 10, are there yet the treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked, and the scant measure that is abominable? Notice the word yet, a key word here. I believe the point is, after all of my warnings, and after all of the lesser chastisements that I have brought, are you still living in wickedness? Are you still heaping up stolen treasures in your houses? And are you still using the scant measure that is abominable? Literally, the ephah of leanness. And it's saying they were cheating on their weights and measures when they would weigh out things on scales in business transactions. A scant measure. And so somebody paid for an ephah's worth of whatever, but it was a scant measure that they gave them. It wasn't a full ephah. And that was strictly forbidden, Deuteronomy 25:14 and following. Well, that's not exactly what you call doing justly, is it? And loving mercy, you know, as he said. See, so he's showing that. Shall I count them pure with the wicked balances and with the bag of deceitful weights? The implied answer is no, they're not pure. Literally, shall I be pure with these things? And I think God is putting himself in the place of man, and he's saying, if I did that, would I be justified in doing that? Were I a man? And again, the answer is no. 12, for the rich men thereof are full of violence, and the inhabitants thereof have spoken lies, and their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. The inhabitants thereof, referring to Jerusalem, which was mentioned as the city, verse 9. 13, therefore also will I make thee sick in smiting thee, in making thee desolate because of thy sins. He seems to be saying here that he has smitten them with an incurable or a mortal wound. That there is no escaping it. 14, thou shalt eat, but not be satisfied, and thy casting down shall be in the midst of thee, and thou shalt take hold, but shall not deliver, and that which thou deliverest, will I give up to the sword. Thy casting down, this is found here only in the Old Testament, but it's coming from a root which means to be void or to be empty. He seems to be saying, you're going to eat, but you won't be satisfied, and your emptiness will remain within you. What a telling illustration of the state of man without God. They're eating, meaning they're imbibing anything and everything that they feel that they need to meet their needs, but they're not satisfied with that, and the emptiness, the void, you know, Pascal's God-shaped vacuum in the heart of every man, remains within them. And then he says, you will take hold but shall not deliver. That is, when the enemy is coming, you'll take hold of your family and your property, your goods to escape, but you won't be able to deliver yourself. You will be captured. NES renders 14. You will eat, but you will not be satisfied, and your vileness will be in your midst. So they render that even stronger than emptiness. Render it vileness, in fact, marginal rendering, or possibly garbage or excreta. So very strong rendering. You will try to remove for safekeeping, but you will not preserve anything. And what you do preserve, I will give to the sword. 15. Thou shalt sow, but you shall not reap. You shall tread the olives, but you shall not anoint thee with oil, and sweet wine, but you shall not drink wine. So you're going to sow, but you won't be able to reap those crops because the enemy is going to take you into captivity. The enemy will have those crops, if anything. You're just a little bit early there, Wayne. And this is a fulfillment of a threat that God had given them through Moses back in Leviticus chapter 26 and verse 16. Looked like Paul Revere about ready to say the British are coming there. Verse 16. For the statutes of Omri are kept, and all the works of the house of Ahab, and you walk in their counsels, that I should make thee a desolation, and the inhabitants thereof an hissing. Therefore you shall bear the reproach of my people. Now here's an interesting statement. And ever so often he'll say something like this. There's a statement in Jeremiah where he says, because of the sins of Manasseh, you know, and what the iniquity that he did, I will cause you to go into captivity. So here we see, now see, these are both Israelite kings. Omri was the father of Ahab. And so Omri and his son Ahab brought Baal worship into Israel. And this was a long time before this, of course, back in Elijah's day. And Ahab had even married Jezebel, who was the daughter of the prince Ethbaal, who was the high priest of Baal worship among the Phoenicians. And now he's saying, you, Judah, now the southern kingdom, much later, you're keeping these statutes of Omri and all these works of the house of Ahab, and you're walking in their counsels. And of course we know that one reason for that was that Athaliah, daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, ruled in Judah for a while, and she brought a lot of that iniquity into Israel, Judah. A parallel statement is in 2 Chronicles 28:2, where it says that the Judean king Ahaz, quote, walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, unquote. And remember, Micah ministered during the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. So it's contemporary. Then he says, I'll close with this, that I should make you an hissing. That means an object of scorn or contempt here, Lamentations 2:15. And you shall bear the reproach of my people. They boasted of being God's people. Now he says, well, that's only increasing your judgment, because to whom much is given, much is required. All right, we'll continue this tomorrow.